So for tonight, I wanted to speak on the topic of the hindrances and this theme in particular of how we can turn through active awareness obstacles, what appear to be obstacles, into opportunities for transformation, opportunities for awakening. You know, mindfulness is sometimes like turning on a flashlight and illuminating the stuff that we haven't been interested in looking at for a while. And so you get, you know, sometimes there's surprise when you flip it on, what comes into the frame of that light, you know, the cobwebs and just like the creepy shit that we're ordinarily, not looking around for. The light, the flashlight, you know, what we normally illuminate is, you know, ways to find comfort and, you know, strategies for experiencing ease, and that oftentimes these strategies aren't so effective, that in our attempts to find happiness, we often create distress. In our attempts to find some ease and well-being, we're often avoiding very important things, you know, emotional experiences and psychological experiences that are, you know, calling out to us. And so sometimes when we sit down quietly, what we get is we get the mud. It's illuminating the habits of mind, developing intimacy with the mind, listening with interest. And it's almost the developing of the skill of listening. You know, we are conditioned to solve problems. That's what our brain does. That's what the executive function of the brain does, is it problem solves. You know, but things like emotions don't want you to solve them. They don't want you to fix them. They want you to listen. And what's needed? How do you care for the mind? How do you care for these parts of ourselves? So this is the, you know, development of insight and wisdom. The more that we sit with ourselves, the more that we are interested in looking into the mind, you know, the more that we become familiar with, good, bad, or otherwise. This is, you know, this is kind of what we get. And we come to also develop a more functional relationship with these parts of ourselves. You know, the parts that we push away, we start to invite a little bit more into the frame and say, all right, you know, spend a little bit of time with you, setting healthy boundaries with the parts of ourselves and the parts of the mind that aren't so helpful. You know, and our emotional experiences that often create and generate distress, setting healthy limits on how we experience emotions. And this is all abstract. I mean, it's a, you know, metaphor for you know, what we do internally every day, but you know, this is the world is somewhat abstract in this way. And the Buddha, I really like this quote I often say by Carl Jung. He said, "One does not become enlightened by imagining figures of light, but by making the darkness conscious. The latter procedure, however, is disagreeable and therefore not popular." And, you know, many of our minds, darkness, as he says, or the shadow of our experience, is simply made up of protective strategies. You know, there are defenses that have often kept us safe in certain areas of our lives, or evolutionarily have kept us safe, but don't necessarily lead to our ease and well-being. I talked about some of these strategies last week, the tendency for narrow-mindedness, to focus only on the fundamental or basic components of an experience rather than the whole picture. This is either or, black and white, all or nothing, instead of both and. The protective strategy for fixation, where we fix and we relate to our present experiences based upon old information and associations. The tendency towards rumination is where we compulsively and incessantly look at the causes and conditions of our distress. This repetitive cycle of the causes and conditions of our distress rather than potential solutions. Trying to figure it out. And also proliferation. Proliferation is the habit of mind to build evidence and a case for its emotions, to create an often dramatic or fantastic story for our emotions. And that it's important that with our, you know, the intrusive parts of our mind, that we recognize these as things that are trying to help us, and in a lot of ways they have, and in a lot of ways they still serve us, but that they're not always useful. And if we're unconscious, we just kind of react from these states and habits of mind without, you know, questioning them, without really understanding how they do cause distress and working to find a new way or a more functional relationship. I like looking at these structures. What I'm talking about, this, you know, defense mechanisms, I guess in Western psychology we could call them, is fortification. And fortification means the action of building a defensive wall or other reinforcement to strengthen a place against attack. So it's where we built up our walls to, you know, protect us from being attacked, from what, you know, Latin vulnere, vulnerability, the susceptibility to woundedness. And that we take risks with being authentic, we take risks with opening ourselves up, and that oftentimes when we were young, we take risks and we find ourselves getting hurt, and so we build up walls to protect. The problem is that when you live behind a wall, you form your own prison, you confine yourself to a, you know, a small space. And the mind constructs its stories out of these, you know, defenses to keep it safe, but the stories end up confining it and locking it up. And the mind and the heart in Buddhist psychology are interrelated. They have the same word, citta. Citta means the heart mind. So when we lock up the mind with stories, we lock up our heart. The Buddha said in one of the discourses that seeing this household life or this life of, you know, kind of our mundane sense of just getting through, just making a living, he said, seeing this household life as a place of dust and confinement, I went forth into the open air. And so part of this is literal, that the Buddha left his home and the life as a householder to become a spiritual mendicant and a wanderer and, you know, to seek. And yes, we could do that. That's an option. But I think it's more of a metaphor for what he is pointing to, is seeing that this life, you know, of, you know, these stories of the mind, the defenses of the mind, the confinement of the mind, you know, that there's a potential and there's an opportunity to move into the open air, to go beyond the walls that we create for ourselves. And this will always take risk. It always means leaving protection. It always means that we have the potential to be hurt. And this is the rub, this is the dukkha that the Buddha pointed to of the path of awakening, is that in order to awaken, we have to, you know, confront our fears. And we do it safely, and we do it with the support of others and with accountability and with the protection of, if you would call yourself a Buddhist, with the protection of the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha, the protection of this path. You know, but we have to take the risk. We have to have, as the Buddha had, this samvega, this urgency to do something different, to try something different, to listen, to be curious in a different, you know, way of relating. So the path that the Buddha encouraged is very practical and pragmatic. If you want to understand your mind, you got to sit down and watch it. So you got to sit and look on to the mind, stand near to the mind, open your heart to the mind, see what it's up to, you know, what it's needing, what it's asking of us. Everything we need, the Buddha said, to free ourselves from these self-made prisons or the stories the mind construct, you know, the tyranny of the mind sometimes it feels like is already within us. And in neuroscience, they point to this similar structure, you know, with metacognition, the ability to observe your own thinking, that we can rewire You know, we have agency over structuring new neural pathways in our brain, that we can, with active awareness, with metacognition, we can actually form different grooves in the brain. So these stories, these defenses actually create almost, you can't point at them, I guess, but they create neural pathways, grooves. And oddly enough, if you've been coming for a while, this is the habit patterns that the Buddha talks about as sankhara, which actually means kind of mental grooves. So if we can construct the world with our minds, we can also deconstruct the world. And ultimately, we can construct a more caring world, or a world that's more in line with reality. One of my favorite phrases these days, something that comes to my mind often, as Byron Katie says, I'm not a spiritual person because I love or admire spirituality, but instead because it hurts like hell to argue with reality. And this is what the Buddha is a realist, you know. I don't think the Buddha gave a shit about spirituality. I think what he cared about was, you know, how our minds generate stress and suffering, and how we can, you know, work to stop arguing with reality, you know, to practice more of a radical acceptance of the way things are, and to incline our minds in that direction. So mindfulness is slowing down. It's very simple. So practically, how does all of this abstract stuff happen? Well, we slow down, we stabilize the mind, we breathe in, we breathe out, and we watch what arises. We simply observe. And much of what we're met with when we observe are the mind's subtle habits. And these hindrances that I'm talking about, or about to talk about, are, you know, the subtle habits of the mind, these kind of patterns that we can become aware of. They're categories of experience. This is the fourth foundation of mindfulness, is mindfulness of dhammas. And dhammas is just, it's just basically like if you have a multiple choice test and you have A, B, C, D, and D is other, or, you know, all of the above, rather, the dhammas or categories of experience, mindfulness of that is just all of the above. Mindfulness of ways that your mind works, or mindfulness of ways that you, or patterns that you can become aware of. So the hindrances are simply just some patterns that you can, it's almost a map you can look at. And there are more than one map, so you can pull out different maps and they point to different things. And the hindrance map is just looking at these particular five qualities of mind. It's not intending to be a big T truth, like these are all that exists in your mind. Instead, it's pointing towards just a part of our experience. And so these subtle habits of these hindrances are looking at the states of mind that are craving, the tendency of mind to lean in or to want for or to wait for or to anticipate experience, the quality of mind that is aversive, meaning not wanting. It's like wanting in the other direction, wanting to go away or to get rid of, or hatred. The quality of mind that is, I really like the way Ajahn Sucitto talks about this, leaning on itself, which is sloth and torpor, or a sense of lazy, dull, you know, disconnected type of state of mind. The fourth is restlessness and worry. Restlessness and worry, I think we're all very familiar with. It's the state of mind that is hyperactive, that's preoccupied. And lastly is the state of mind of doubt. And doubt is quite a big category and can mean a lot of things. So I want to look at these, and in particular a couple ways to work with these, and just to open it up then and to hear from you all about your experience. The first is, you know, how do we look at craving in the mind? Traditionally, this is called sense desire. So in particular, you know, sense desire is what in Pali Sanskrit is called kama tanha, which is this thirst to fulfill or to satiate the thirst, right? So there's this kind of like needing for something to fill the senses. So sense desire, needing for something good to look at, to smell, to taste, to hear, to feel, you know, something to kind of take in through through the senses. Sense desire, we make a distinction between what desire is and what craving is. And craving is demanding the satisfaction of the desire. So desire is a neutral mental faculty in Buddhist psychology. It actually has no ethical implications one way or another. Desire is just a necessary thing that comes on the hard drive. I want for things. I would like things, right? But the passion behind the desire, when the desire kicks in and there's a sense of having to have or an anticipating around it, there's a leaving or a moving forward into something to grab after or grasp towards it, to bring it close. So you can look at this as craving and clinging are kind of the two forms of sense desire. And craving can be anything from obsession to anticipation to wanting to leaning into or leaning forward into an experience. Clinging can be holding on to, grasping, contracting around. It's kind of the death grip of the mind. And then there's, of course, around our senses, this kama tanha, this thirst to find something that's going to satiate us. So we go out into the world and there's tons of opportunities to stimulate the senses. And that, again, it's not a judgment of desire. The Buddha actually talks extensively about all the joy that's to be had through the senses. That, we find a lot of pleasure and a lot of contentment through our senses. There's a lot of wonderful things we can experience in this world, but it's our relationship to that. It's the urgency of behind that. It's the motivation behind that that we're looking at. There's also another form of craving that's a little more subtle and I think almost more rampant than this craving for sense desire is a craving, they call it kama tanha, which means a craving to become something. It's a craving to become something or craving for something to exist. So this can be anything from looking at if only I was, or if only this situation could be blank. So how do we work with craving? The first step of working with craving in the mind is to become aware that that's there, that it's present. This is the biggest, most simple prize of mindfulness is simple active awareness of things. Knowing, oh, this is craving in the mind. Identifying that as craving. Because once you have the information, you have more of an ability to respond. When we don't have that identification of recognition, oh, that's what that is, we act it out. If you think about emotions and we talk about little kids acting out, right? Their behaviors, acting out, we say that a lot. And you act things out when you don't have language for it. So you don't have to act anything out. If you think of charades, you're not allowed to speak, so you have to act out what your category is. And when you don't have language for craving, when you don't identify that this is what this is, it just happens. It just flows out. So recognizing that craving is present and recognizing also when craving is absent. Knowing and noticing the cooling down of the craving, noticing and knowing what supports that cooling down is a very important part of working with this state of mind. So some things, ways you can identify, just to recap a little bit, is how do I know I'm craving? There's a sense of leaning into the next thing. So even when I'm sitting in meditation and my mind is, oh, what am I going to have for dinner later? What am I going to watch on Netflix later? That sense of, again, not judging that, just noticing that, oh, that's leaning in. That's kind of, anticipating, moving into the next. When you lean into the next, what happens is it creates momentum. So we're often living between what we're doing right now and what we're going to do next. That's how time, we have constructed time. So I work. Right now I'm at against the stream and I have to do this group. The next thing I have to do is this. And then I have to wake up at this time in the morning. And so we often lean into those next things without becoming aware of it. And when you do that, you create, you don't really take active delight in our experiences. You know, we're kind of constantly preparing. So that's one thing we can become aware of, leaning in. And also just being preoccupied, noticing when the attention continues to go back to the same thing over and over again is a way to notice and note craving in the mind. There's the formula for stress, which is if only X, then Y. So the tendency of mind to say, well, if only this could happen, then I would be happy. Right? If only I could get, go on this trip next week, then I would be happy. If only I had more money, then I would be happy. If only these people in my life acted differently, then I would be happy. If only I had a different job. If only I had a different... I mean, the list goes on and on. There's another subtle, nuanced way that craving can manifest. There's also the in order to mind, which is how we often do some action in order to make something else happen. So I'm going to do this in order to do that. And that can oftentimes be craving too. So just identifying. And then also noticing the absence. You know, we are often so flooded with sensory information, it's hard to notice when the craving is... It's like, well, yeah, you just named pretty much 90% of what my mind does. How do I, you know, break free from what my mind does all the time? Is, you know, to notice when it's absent. To notice, you know, often we notice this during meditation. After 10, 15 minutes of settling in, the mind, you know, kind of stops leaping up as much. Still leaps up, but you know, it settles in a little bit. Allowing our experience to be good enough, tolerating the ordinary, tolerating things that we've made up like boredom. All boredom is craving. You know, boredom isn't a real thing. It's just a sense of not tolerating the right now. And again, there are no judgments around these things. It's like, this is what the mind does. It wants to be entertained. After we, you know, practice mindfulness for some time, there's often like pink cloud period where we have some space and we get a little bit of space from the mind and we experience a little bit of the cooling down and it's a little bit nice. And then there's almost like a little bit of a withdrawal period. We often see that we've had kind of dependence on certain thing, you know, thinking patterns or ways of craving with the mind. And so, you know, we sometimes have a hard time withdrawing from that. The emotions that the craving was covering up start to come to the surface. Then you get a little bit of loneliness or you get a little bit of the sadness or that stuff can arise. And so part of working with craving is working with the underlying, you know, the underlying, what's underneath that. Knowing what's leading to the arising and removal of the craving. So what is, yeah, the underlying, what is leading to the arisal of that, arising of that boredom, like I mentioned, loneliness, afflictive emotions, anxiety can lead to craving. Some activating event, something happens, we're not, you know, really paying attention, and then 10, 15 minutes down the road, we're, you know, wanting to go eat our, you know, fifth meal of the day at Taco Bell, or, you know, wanting to go text the ex, or wanting to go, you know, drink ourselves into oblivion, or whatever we want to do, you know, noticing also the activating events, so what's underlying a lot of this. And then what will lead to the removal of the craving? Just looking into the mind. What are some skillful means for coping with craving? Healthy forms of distraction. I'm a big fan of harm reduction. If you have an inclination to go to this thing, instead of doing that one, how about you do something that's not going to hurt as bad, right? Or better yet, how about you do something that's going to contribute to more long-term ease? So turning your attention from the craving and the underlying emotion that's oftentimes perpetuating that into something that's more helpful and soothing. And then we can do protective things to help us to work with craving, like looking at our environments. If there are activating events for craving, We want to actually protect the mind. The Buddha encourages to protect the mind. Once we're familiar, we have insight. Oh, every time I talk to this person, this is how I feel. To almost start to set up our environment to say, no, you know, I'm not going to engage with this person, or I'm not going to engage with this person in this way. Developing some boundaries in our environment. Also around behaviors. You know, also around certain, you know, like I'm a person in recovery, and for a long time, you don't go into bars. I wouldn't go into, definitely wouldn't go into the places I used to use hardcore drugs in. You know, it's not a good environment to damper craving. And they say, I actually really love this analogy a lot, and it speaks very directly what we're talking about. If you don't want to get your haircut, don't go into the barbershop, right? That tendency to want to get the haircut once you get there, you know, that you got to protect yourself from environments that well up craving. And then this second state of mind, aversion, which is, I'm only going to speak briefly about because it's the other end of the same coin, which is the pushing away of experience. Aversion has a very wide range of disruptive states. So it can be anything from violent rage and hatred. It can be anger, ill will, animosity, annoyance, irritation, fear. Even in subtle ways, it can manifest as sorrow and grief, pushing away of our sadness, sorrow, and grief. They call aversion the honey-tipped dart because oftentimes, especially when you talk about things like blame, or when the best example of this is road rage. Right, so when you're driving and there's a sense of the story comes out, you know, the fucking new Nashville, and you know they don't have the infrastructure for this yet. I can't believe they have a Titans game and they shut down 24, and you know, this kind of like the honey tip dart is like, it feels good to, like, especially if you can get someone else in on it. And you're like, listen to this shit, and they're like, yeah. And then you kind of, it feels good because there's a catharsis. There's an emoting of that. The problem is that when you cathart with anger or hatred, what happens is you almost inevitably end up feeling regret. Or you almost always end up feeling shame. And so anger, healthy emotion, they call anger the remover of obstacles. Important emotion. Especially if someone's trapping you in the corner and you need your anger to yell and scream and fight. But we overuse it. And almost, I think, a little bit culturally these days, we used to lean towards don't express anger at all. Especially this kind of southern sense of, you know, don't show that emotion. But now I think we're almost a little too validating of anger. And we don't really have, I mean, this could just be my own perception totally, but I almost see with social media and the, like, you know, kind of incessant negativity, it's not good for the mind. It may be valid, it may be true, but it's not good for the mind to just eat that, you know, to chew on that resentment and anger. And it's an ineffective use of that energy. Anger, when used wisely, is boundaries, it's action, it's, you know, problem solving, it's how do we take care of the injustices in our world, what can I do today, how am I going to go out there and do it, how am I going to, you know, and to talk about it and to spread self-awareness, but looking at the tone and the quality of the mind, because it has this honey-tipped dart, it ends up sticking us. So we can work with, you know, anger, aversion, ill will, agitation, irritability in a lot of different ways, mostly by bringing mindfulness to that, to know that that is in the mind and to know that that's a very powerful force of mind and to watch where that leads. To know the causes, look at physical pain. One of the things I heard also early on in early recovery is, are you hungry, angry, lonely, tired? One of still the best check-ins that you can do is, oftentimes I act a fool when I'm hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. And so to really notice if there's an aversive state of mind that's coming out of, you know, these causes, this physical aspect. You know, so also simply being aware without judging it, you know, inviting our aversion in a little bit, noting and noticing that this is a constant visitor. And when you close your visitors out, you know, they're knocking on the door, they're sleeping on your front porch, and they're making your neighbors look at you funny. You know, you've got to let them in and have some tea, right? Invite Mara to the dinner table and to have a conversation with your anger and to kind of coach yourself through it and to talk with it rationally. Another way to work with anger and hatred, aversion, ill will, agitation is to drop the story and to feel the emotion, the sensory experience. So to work really hard, and it is really hard, to get out of the story quickly and to move into the body, into a state of trying to relax the agitation that's underneath that. You know, and then when we're more regulated from the anger, then you can bring it up to a friend or, you know, therapist or mom or dad, and you can have them help you process through it. But processing, there's debate about this, but Daniel Goleman in his book Emotional Intelligence refers to a study where he says that catharsis, or this process, venting anger, keeps you in an activated arousal state. So it keeps you dysregulated. And what you need to do is to regulate first, drop the story, feel the emotion, calm it down, go for a walk, disengage from the activating event, all of these things. And once you're completely rest and relax, then you can start to process. But then you still need to be watchful, because emotions have residual effect. When they calm down, they have like a little Christmas present of anger waiting with them. So as soon as you open up the story again, it's like a jack in the box. It's going to just fly in your face. So you got to, you know, be careful. And are you in a safe person or with a safe person to express this? And do you have enough time to process this? Another way, and I'll, move through this a little bit quickly, but, you know, to prevent the future arising of aversion is to develop. One more thing I want to say. So another thing when anger is present is to distract, to think about something else. This is what the Buddha offers as a last resolve. He says, if you're trying all of these things to work skillfully, not being judgeful, you know, the mind, being kind with the mind, you know, dropping the story, feeling the emotion, talking to a wise friend, if none of these things work, just freaking do something else. Right, and put all of your attention and effort into disengaging from that. And of course, one of the most time-honored Buddhist phrases is hatred never ceases by hatred, but by love alone is healed. And this is this repetitive nature of hatred, that hatred feeds and fuels on itself. Developing the practice of metta, loving kindness, sitting daily and practicing loving kindness meditation is an antidote for the future arising of anger. This doesn't mean, again, that we say, I'm never going to be angry, but instead we say, my intention is to meet myself and others in kindness and care and concern. And if I'm keeping that at the forefront of my mind, it's, again, another protective thing that doesn't let as much anger seep through the filter. Sloth and torpor and restlessness and worry. I want to talk about these two states. Opposite ends of an energy diagram or whatever. On one end you have restlessness and worry, which is a hyperactivity. On the other end you have this resignation, which is a sense of kind of leaning back or not having any motivation or not having any sense of effort. Sloth and torpor. Sloth is a sluggishness of consciousness. Consciousness just means wakeful. So it's just a sense of not being wakeful. And then torpor is a sluggishness of mental factors like attention, inquiry, mental energy, self-awareness. It's the mind that loves to hit the snooze button in the morning, That's the sloth and torpor mind. Five more minutes. So it's beyond just being sleepy. There's this sense of putting off or this sense of laziness or not, you know, just kind of not. It's dull and uninterested. This oftentimes can just come from being tired and needing more sleep. And again, like all of these states, constant reminder, we're not judging sloth and torpor. We're not trying to get rid of it. We're trying to skillfully work with it. So sometimes you're tired. Sometimes you fall asleep during meditation. Totally cool. Happens all the time. Actually, usually what happens, I say usually just because I've heard this a lot, is the tendency when first starting a mindfulness practice is to have restlessness and worry. And over a month or two of practice, if you practice daily, there's a sense of kind of moving more towards the other end of that spectrum, which is the mind has actually learned to slow down, but it's kind of gone beyond this present awareness and kind of into this leaning, sluggish type of attention. So it can be, and I don't want to be definitive about this, but it can actually be a good sign that you're in your, I think it is a good sign that you're more in your parasympathetic nervous system, meaning you're more in your rest and relaxed state. And then it's just kind of encouraging curiosity and interest. So that's one way to work with sloth and torpor is to, you can practice in meditation noting or labeling breath. You can note in on the inhalation, out on the exhalation. You can count breaths. You can open your eyes and let some light in. You can practice different forms of mindfulness. If you're just sitting there and you're just kind of falling asleep the whole time, you know, do a little bit of walking meditation. You know, you kind of have a little bit of standing upright and opening and moving forward and back. Sloth and torpor can also be the result of emotional overwhelm. It's again another fortification or defense. So we get really, you know, checked out, or you get really sluggish when there's emotional exhaustion or when there's an intense emotion that the mind doesn't want to experience. So it keeps it out by not keeping it alert. There's a sense of like, you know, almost dissociation, checking out. Who we can work with this mostly with curiosity, you know, just staying interested, switching the forms of practice. If I'm sitting in a chair, I usually move more to the front of the chair. It's harder to fall asleep if I'm not kind of leaning back. Watching the posture, so, you know, kind of coming back to if I get really tired, just kind of, you know, adjusting my posture a little bit. Looking at, is there an emotion that, if I wasn't tired, what would I be feeling right now? Is a good inquiry. If I wasn't tired, what would I be feeling right now? Just interested in that. Maybe there's nothing there, but asking that question. With restlessness and worry, this can be anything from agitation to excitement almost. It can be a, you know, excited sense of restlessness, or it can be distracted sense of restlessness. If you just think of that word, restlessness means without rest. So when the mind has a high frequency of thoughts, it's restless. It doesn't rest between thoughts. There's a, that state of mind is present. I would define this as restlessness is a sense of feeling scattered, and worry is the habit of mind to compulsively focus attention on the symptoms of our distress, on its causes and consequences, as opposed to its solution. So the same definition I give worry to rumination. It's the same thing from mental state. So as we work with restlessness, there are actually a lot of things that we can do to help with restlessness. And for all of the hindrances, actually, one of the things I didn't mention is the Buddha included the words of a wise friend. So that friendship helps us to, you know, regulate our emotions and to work with a lot of these states, you know, helping us to feel calm or safe, especially if we're really overwhelmed by anxiety, like on the verge of panic attacks, having something, someone grounding that we can be around to connect with. Also different forms of meditation, sitting, moving to walking meditation or opening your eyes again. Also laying down meditation. If you find yourself really restless, you know, really you know, caught up in worry, laying down and just focusing on this simple practice is as you're sitting, know that you're sitting, or doing some really deep breathing practices, or relaxing your body from the top of your head to the bottom of your feet. The important thing when you're restless is to give yourself time. If there's one key to helping to relax restlessness, is you have to have time. You have to give yourself time. It's a patient, long process to, you know, as soon as there's a figuring it out again, or go, you're back into the worry, and that generates speed. So you have to, you know, sometimes when I'm really restless, I put my phone away and I go on a walk with my dog, and I'll go on a walk for 15, 20 minutes, focusing on my footsteps, petting my dog every, you know, so often, just to really give myself time. If you try to hurry it up, it's going to create more anxiety. If you hate your anxiety, it's going to create more anxiety. If you try to push anxiety away, it will create more anxiety. The only thing to do is to give your anxiety time. You can also practice metta to the anxiety. Metta, if you're new, is a, you know, intentionally developing a, you know, state of ease. May I be at ease with this mind? May I be at ease? May you be at ease, mind? It's like self-soothing internally. And lastly, working with doubt. Doubt is the most formidable of all of the hindrances. It is the hindrance that was the final visitor to the Buddha in the mythological story of his awakening, when Mara couldn't any longer attack him with craving and sense desire, and couldn't longer attack him with hatred, restlessness, worry, sloth, and torpor. Mara came disguised as doubt. And doubt is the sense of that you don't deserve this, that this isn't going to work, that you're on the wrong path, you should do something different. That this sense of doubt finds its way into a lot of our states of mind, and often disguises itself as discernment or wisdom. You know, but oftentimes it's a sense of cynicism or distrust. You know, there's this like, I don't trust this. This isn't right. This isn't good. This isn't, you know, talking ourselves out of. So it can show up as doubt in a spiritual path, whether it's this path or any other path. You know, we see sometimes kind of like tendency for spiritual materialism or shopping around in different spiritual communities. We take a little bit of this and we do a little bit of that and we do a little bit of that, and trying things. I was trying things that are good, but there's this almost like doubting in a spiritual path, not sticking it out, not staying committed for a period of time. You know, trying it out, but then trying it on once we try it out and it feels right. Trying it on means taking time with it, wearing it for a while. And the Buddha says that none of his teachings need to be believed in, that there are only, you know, once we have taken these things on, these practices, and for ourselves have determined that they are helpful, then we should abide in them, then we should have faith in them. But the problem with experiential faith is you can't develop it without experience. So we need faith, almost enough faith to just say, you know, I'm going to try it out for some time. Unfortunately, for many of us, the initial faith comes from desperation. This isn't working. This is really bad. Okay, fine. I'll go sit with the Buddhists in this weird meditation center in East Nashville, right? So it's like this sense of that's how I got here. I had 5 years in recovery, and I was waking up suicidal every day, and I was a good person. I was living in my integrity. Yeah, but this cynicism and pessimism, this doubt plagued my mind. This negativity, this anger turned inward, this depression plagued my mind. And so it was only out of desperation. I was like, fine, I'll go sit with it. I'll go see. I'll try it out for some time and see what happens. Doubt in a spiritual path. Also doubt in our own path. You know, kind of indecision. You know, doubting ourselves. Self-doubt. So how we work with this is just staying, you know, mindfully attuned to our thoughts. Noticing, starting to recognize voices of shame. Shame. I've always felt this way. I'm always going to feel this way. I'm the only one that feels this way. A sense of feeling separate from the other. This is the voice of shame. It's the voice that talks ourselves out of feeling worthy or able. It's all bullshit, right? But it's so convincing because it's in my own voice. And I'm so used to hearing shame usually that I don't even question it. I don't even see it. It's just bought. Yeah. You know, that's something that with mindfulness, we can start to listen to that. We can start to pick up on that. Asking with doubt, this really helps me a lot of times, is this thought actually helpful? Is it directly helpful? So a lot of my doubt are about big existential, am I in the right profession? Am I doing the, is that helping me today? Is it worthy of my time to think about my life and its existence and all this shit that's just freaking me out? You know? So doubt can oftentimes be dampered just by being like, dude, that's not even going to solve anything right now. So focusing very, you know, on the here and now and back on our path. Lastly, what I'll share is two quick things. Wise reflection on what's worked in the past and why we're here. So oftentimes when I found myself in experiences of depression, which for me often manifests in a lot of self-doubt or shame, is a visitor during times of depression for me, what helps is reflecting on, well, what's worked in the past, what's been helpful. You know, remembering past experiences of doubt and how I got through them. So almost like reflecting on that or journaling about that can be helpful. And lastly, practicing, you know, practices of faith. The Buddha said that clinging to rituals and ceremony are a dead end, but rituals and ceremony also are very helpful to have us reestablish a connection with our faith. So, you know, taking refuge, if you've been coming for a while, in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha each day, and knowing, you know, there's a reason I signed up for this. There's a reason that I, you don't have to sign up for this, by the way. There's a reason why I've shown up for this. There's a reason why I keep coming, and that I want to connect with that reason every day. If you hold that in mind, it can be protecting of self-doubt. So these are some reflections. I know it's a lot. This is my tendency to give a lot of information. But what we want to encourage is some open discussion, just to hear from you all about your experience. You know, you don't have to be an expert on anything other than your own experience. So the floor is